Still feeling numb, Shallan fetched Jasnah a sleeping robe as the woman removed her jewelry and set it on the dressing table. "You could have let the other three get away," Shallan said, walking back toward Jasnah, who had sat down to brush her hair. "You only needed to kill one of them."
"No, I didn't," Jasnah said.
"Why? They would have been too frightened to do something like that again."
"You don't know that. I sincerely wanted those men gone. A careless barmaid walking home the wrong way cannot protect herself, but I can. And I will."
"You have no authority to do so. Not in someone else's city."
"True," Jasnah said. "Another point to consider, I suppose."
She raised the brush to her hair, pointedly turning away from Shallan. She closed her eyes, as if to shut Shallan out. The soulcaster sat on the dressing table beside Jasnah's earrings. Shallan gritted her teeth, holding the soft silken robe. Jasnah sat in her white underdress, brushing her hair.
"There will be times when you must make decisions that churn your stomach, Shallan Devar.
I've faced them already. I'm facing one now." "How dare Jasnah do this? How dare she make Shallan a part of it? How dare she use something beautiful and holy as a device for destruction? Jasnah didn't deserve to own the soulcaster." With a swift move of her hand, Shallan tucked the folded robe under her safe arm, then shoved her hand into her safe pouch and popped the intact smoke stone from her father's soulcaster. She stepped up to the dressing table, and using the motion of placing the robe onto the table as a cover, made the exchange. She slid the working soulcaster into her safe hand within its sleeve, stepping back as Jasnah opened her eyes and glanced at the robe, which now sat innocently beside the non-functional soulcaster. Shallan's breath caught in her throat. Jasnah closed her eyes again, handing the brush toward Shallan.
50 strokes tonight, Shallan. It has been a fatiguing day."
Shallan moved by rote, brushing her mistress's hair while clutching the stolen soulcaster in her hidden safe hand, panicked that Jasnah would notice the swap at any moment. She didn't. Not when she put on her robe. Not when she tucked the broken soulcaster away in her jewelry case and locked it with a key she wore around her neck as she slept. Shallan walked from the room, stunned, in turmoil, exhausted, sickened, confused, but undiscovered.
Thirty-seven. Sides. 5.5 years ago.
"Kaladin, look at this rock," Tian said. "It changes colors when you look at it from different sides."
Kaladin looked away from the window, glancing at his brother. Now 13 years of age, Tian had turned from an eager boy into an eager adolescent. Though he'd grown, he was still small for his age, and his mop of blackened brown hair still refused all attempts at order. He was squatting beside the lacquered cobwood dinner table, eyes level with the glossy surface, looking at a small, lumpish rock. Cal sat on a stool, peeling long roots with a short knife. The brown roots were dirty on the outside, and sticky when he sliced into them, so working on them coated his fingers with a thick layer of creme. He finished a root and handed it up to his mother, who washed it off and sliced it into the stew pot.
"Mother, look at this," Tian said.
Late afternoon sunlight streamed through the lee side window, bathing the table.
"From this side, the rock sparkles red. But from the other side, it's green."
"Perhaps it's magical," Hasina said.
Chunk after chunk of long root plunked into the water, each splash with a slightly different note.
"I think it must be," Tian said. "Or it has a spren.
Do spren live in rocks?"
"Spren live in everything," Hasina replied.
"They can't live in everything," Cal said, dropping a peel into the pail at his feet. He glanced out the window, watching the road that led from the town to the city lord's mansion.
"They do," Hasina said.
Spren appear when something changes, when fear appears or when it begins to rain. They are the heart of change, and therefore the heart of all things.
This is Long Root, Cal said, holding it up skeptically.
Has a spren?
And if you slice it up?
Each bit has a spren, only smaller.
Cal frowned, looking over the long tuber. They grew in cracks in the stone where water collected. They tasted faintly of minerals, but were easy to grow. His family needed food that didn't cost much these days.
So we eat spren, Cal said flatly.
No, she said. We eat the roots.
When we have to, Tian added with a grimace.
And the spren, Cal pressed.
They are freed. To return to wherever it is that spren live.
Do I have a spren? Tian asked, looking down at his chest.
You have a soul, dear. You are a person. But the pieces of your body may very well have spren living in them, very small ones.
Tian pinched at his skin as if trying to pry the tiny spren out.
Dung, Cal said suddenly.
Cal, Hasina snapped. That's not talk for mealtime.
Dung, Cal said stubbornly.
It has spren?
I suppose it does.
Dung spren, Tian said, then snickered. His mother continued to chop.
Why all of these questions suddenly?
Cal shrugged.
I don't know.
Because. He'd been thinking recently about the way the world worked, about what he was to do with his place in it. The other boys his age, they didn't wonder about their place. Most knew what their future held, working in the fields. Cal had a choice, though. Over the last several months, he'd finally made that choice. He would become a soldier. He was 15 now, and could volunteer when the next recruiter came through town. He planned to do just that. No more wavering, he would learn to fight. That was the end of it.
Wasn't it?
I want to understand, he said. I just want everything to make sense. His mother smiled at that, standing in her brown work dress, hair pulled back in a tail, the top hidden beneath her yellow kerchief.
What? He demanded.
Why are you smiling?
You just want everything to make sense.
Yes. Well, next time the Ardens come through the town to burn prayers and elevate people's callings, I'll pass the message along. She smiled. Until then, keep peeling roots.
Cal sighed, but did as she told him.
He checked out the window again and nearly dropped the root in shock. The carriage. It was coming down the roadway from the mansion. He felt a flutter of nervous hesitation. He'd planned, he'd thought, but now that the time was upon him, he wanted to sit and keep peeling. There would be another opportunity, surely.
No.
He stood, trying to keep the anxiety from his voice.
I'm going to rinse off.
He held up creme-covered fingers.
You should have washed the roots off first, as I told you, his mother noted.
I know, Cal said. Did his sigh of regret sound fake?
Maybe I'll just wash them all off now.
Hasina said nothing as he gathered up the remaining roots, crossed to the door, heart thumping, and stepped out into the evening light.
See? Tian said from behind. From this side it's green. I don't think it's a spren, Mother. It's the light. It makes the rock change.
The door swung closed. Cal set down the tubers and charged through the streets of Hearthstone, passing men chopping wood, women throwing out dishwater, and a group of grandfathers sitting on steps and looking at the sunset. He dunked his hands in a rain barrel, but didn't stop as he shook the water free. He ran around Mabro Pigherder's house, up past the common water, the large hole cut into the rock at the center of the town to catch rain, and along the break wall, the steep hillside against which the town was built to shield it from storms. Here he found a small stand of stump-weight trees. Knobby and about as tall as a man, they grew leaves only on their leeward sides, running down the length of the tree like rungs on a ladder, waving in the cool breeze. As Cal got close, the large, banner-like leaves snapped up close to the trunks, making a series of whipping sounds. Cal's father stood on the other side, hands clasped behind his back. He was waiting where the road from the manor turned past Hearthstone. Liren turned with a start, noticing Cal. He wore his finest clothing, a blue coat, buttoning up the sides like a light-eyes coat. But it was over a pair of white trousers that showed wear. He studied Cal through his spectacles.
"I'm going with you," Cal blurted. "Up to the mansion."
"How did you know?"
"Everyone knows," Cal said. "You think they wouldn't talk if Brightlord Brishone invited you to dinner? You, of all people?"
Liren looked away.
"I told your mother to keep you busy."
"She tried,"
Cal grimaced. "I'll probably hear a storm of it when she finds those Longroots sitting outside the front door." Liren said nothing. The carriage rolled to a stop nearby, wheels grinding against the stone.
"This will not be a pleasant, idle meal, Cal," Liren said.
"I'm not a fool, father."
When Hesina had been told there was no more need for her to work in the town, well, there was a reason they'd been reduced to eating Longroots.
"If you're going to confront him, then you should have someone to support you."
"And that someone is you?"
"I'm pretty much all you have."
The coachman cleared his throat. He didn't get down and open the door the way he did for Brightlord Brishone. Liren eyed Cal.
"If you send me back, I'll go," Cal said.
"No, come along if you must." Liren walked up to the carriage and pulled open the door. It wasn't the fancy gold-trimmed vehicle that Brishone used. This was the second carriage, the older brown one. Cal climbed in, feeling a surge of excitement at the small victory, and an equal measure of panic. They were going to face Brishone. Finally. The benches inside were amazing, the red cloth covering them softer than anything Cal had ever felt. He sat down, and the seat was surprisingly springy. Liren sat across from Cal, pulling the door closed, and the coachman snapped his whip at the horses. The vehicle turned around and rattled back up the road. As soft as the seat was, the ride was terribly bumpy, and it rattled Cal's teeth against one another. It was worse than riding in a wagon, though that was probably because they were going faster.
"Why didn't you want us to know about this?" Cal asked.
"I wasn't certain I'd go."
"What else would you do?"
"Move away," Liren said. "Take you to Cabranth and escape this town, this kingdom, and Rishon's petty grudges."
Cal blinked in shock. He'd never thought of that. Suddenly everything seemed to expand. His future changed, wrapping upon itself, folding into a new form entirely. Father, mother, Tien, with him.
"Really?"
Liren nodded absently.
"Even if we didn't go to Carbranth, I'm sure many Alethi towns would welcome us. Most have never had a surgeon to care for them. They do the best they can with local men who learned most of what they know from superstition or working on the occasional wounded chul. We could even move to Kulinar. I'm skilled enough to get work as a physician's assistant there."
"Why don't we go then? Why haven't we gone?"
Liren watched out the window.
"I don't know. We should leave. It makes sense. We have the money. We aren't wanted here. The city lord hates us, the people mistrust us, the Stormfather himself seems inclined to knock us down."
There was something in Liren's voice. Regret?
"I tried very hard to leave once," Liren said, more softly. "But there's a tie between a man's home and his heart. I've cared for these people, Cal. Delivered their children, set their bones, healed their scrapes. You've seen the worst of them these last few years. But there was a time before that. A good time."
He turned to Cal, clasping his hands in front of him, the carriage rattling.
"They're mine, son. And I'm theirs. They're my responsibility, now that Wistio has gone. I can't leave them to Roshan. Even if they like what he's doing? Particularly because of that. Liren raised a hand to his head. Stormfather, it sounds more foolish now that I say it. No, I understand. I think. Cal shrugged. I guess, well, they still come to us when they're hurt. They complain about how unnatural it is to cut into a person, but they still come. I used to wonder why. And did you come to a conclusion? Kind of. I decided that in the end they'd rather be alive to curse at you a few more days. It's what they do. Just like healing them is what you do. And they used to give you money. A man can say all kinds of things, but where he sets his spheres, that's where his heart is. Cal frowned. I guess they did appreciate you. Liren smiled. Wise words. I keep forgetting that you're nearly a man, Cal. When did you go and grow up on me? That night when we were nearly robbed, Cal thought immediately. That night when you shone light on the men outside and showed that bravery had nothing to do with a spear held in battle. You're wrong about one thing, though, Liren said. You told me that they did appreciate me. But they still do. Oh, they grumble. They've always done that. But they also leave food for us. Cal started. They do? How do you think we've been eating these last 4 months? But they're frightened of Roshan, so they're quiet about it. They left it for your mother when she went to clean, or put it in the rain barrel when it's empty. They tried to rob us. And those very men were among the ones who gave us food as well. Cal pondered that as the carriage arrived at the manor house. It had been a long time since he'd visited the large two-story building. It was constructed with a standard roof that sloped toward the stormward side, but was much larger. The walls were of thick white stones, and it had majestic square pillars on the leeward side. Would he see Laurel here? He was embarrassed by how infrequently he thought about her these days. The mansion's front grounds had a low stone wall covered with all kinds of exotic plants. Rock buds lined the top, their vines draping down the outside. Clusters of a bulbous variety of shale bark grew along the inside, bursting with a variety of bright colors. Oranges, reds, yellows, and blues. Some outcroppings looked like heaps of clothing, with folds spread like fans. Others grew out like horns. Most had tendrils like threads that waved in the wind. Right Lord Roshan paid much more attention to his grounds than Wistio had. They walked up past the whitewashed pillars and entered between the thick wooden storm doors. The vestibule inside had a low ceiling and was decorated with ceramics. Zircon spheres gave them a pale blue cast. A tall servant in a long black coat and a bright purple cravat greeted them. He was Natir, the steward now that Mylev had died. He'd been brought in from Dalalak, a large coastal city to the north. Natir led them to a dining room where Roshan sat at a long dark wood table. He'd gained weight, though not enough to be called fat. He still had that gray-flecked beard, and his hair was greased back down to his collar. He wore white trousers and a tight red vest over a white shirt. He'd already begun his meal, and the spicy scents made Cal's stomach rumble. How long had it been since he'd had pork? There were 5 different dipping sauces on the table, and Roshan's wine was a deep, crystalline orange. He ate alone, no sign of Laurel or his son. The servant gestured toward a side table set up in a room next to the dining hall. Cal's father took one look at it, then walked to Roshan's table and sat down. Roshan paused, skewer halfway to his lips, spicy brown sauce dripping to the table before him. "I'm of the second none," Liren said, "and I have a personal invitation to dine with you. Surely you follow the precepts of rank closely enough to give me a place at your table?" Roshan clenched his teeth but did not object.
Taking a deep breath, Cal sat down beside his father. Before he left to join the war on the shattered plains, he had to know. Was his father a coward or a man of courage? By the light of spheres at home, Liren had always seemed weak. He worked in his surgery room, ignoring what the townspeople said about him. He told his son he couldn't practice with the spear and forbade him to think of going to war. Weren't those the actions of a coward? But 5 months ago, Cal had seen courage in him that he'd never expected. And in the calm blue light of Rishon's palace, Liren met the eyes of a man far above him in rank, wealth, and power, and did not flinch. How did he do it? Cal's heart thumped uncontrollably. He had to put his hands in his lap to keep them from betraying his nervousness. Rishon waved to a serving man, and within a short time new places had been set. The periphery of the room was dark. Rishon's table was an illuminated island amid a vast black expanse. There were bowls of water for dipping one's fingers and stiff white cloth napkins beside them. A light-eyes meal. Cal had rarely eaten such fine food. He tried not to make a fool of himself as he hesitantly took a skewer and imitated Rishon, using his knife to slide down the bottommost chunk of meat, then raising it and biting. The meat was savory and tender, though the spices were much hotter than he was accustomed to. Liren did not eat. He rested his elbows on the table, watching the Bright Lord dine.
"I wish to offer you the chance to eat in peace," Rishon said eventually, "before we talked of serious matters. But you don't seem inclined to partake of my generosity."
"No."
"Very well," Rishon said, taking a piece of flatbread from the basket and wrapping it around his skewer, pulling off several vegetable chunks at once and eating them with the bread. "Then tell me, how long do you think you can defy me? Your family is destitute."
"We do just fine," Cal cut in.
Liren glanced at him, but did not chastise him for speaking.
"My son is correct. We can live, and if that doesn't work, we can leave. I will not bend to your will, Rishon."
"If you left," Rishon said, holding up a finger, "I would contact your new city lord and tell him of the spears stolen from me."
"I would win an inquest over that. Besides, as a surgeon, I am immune to most demands you could make." It was true. Men and their apprentices who served an essential function in towns were afforded special protection, even from light eyes.
The Voren legal code of citizenship was complex enough that Kaladin still had difficulty understanding it.
"Yes, you would win an inquest," Rishon said. "You were so meticulous preparing the exact right documents. You were the only one with Wistio when he stamped them. Odd that none of his clerks were there."
"Those clerks read him the documents,
and then left the room, because they were ordered to leave by Bright Lord Wistio. They have admitted this, I believe."
Rishon shrugged.
"I don't need to prove that you stole the spheres, surgeon. I simply have to continue doing as I have been. I know that your family eats scraps. How long will you continue to make them suffer for your pride?"
"They won't be intimidated. And neither will I."
"I'm not asking if you're intimidated. I'm asking if you're starving."
"Not by any means," Liren said, voice growing dry. "If we lack for something to eat, we can feast upon the attention you lavish upon us, Bright Lord. We feel your eyes watching, hear your whispers to the townspeople. Judging from the degree of your concern with us, it would seem that you are the one who is intimidated."
Rishon fell still, skewer held limply in his hand, brilliant green eyes narrowed, lips pursed tight. In the dark, those eyes almost seemed to glow. Cal had to stop himself from cringing under the weight of that disapproving gaze. There was an air of command about light eyes like Rishon.
"He's not a real light eyes. He's a reject. I'll see real ones eventually. Men of honor."
Liren held the gaze evenly.
Every month we resist is a blow to your authority. You can't have me arrested, since I would win an inquest. You've tried to turn the other people against me, but they know, deep down, that they need me.
Roshan leaned forward.
I do not like your little town.
Liren frowned at the odd response.
I do not like being treated like an exile, Roshan continued. I do not like living so far from anything, everything important. And most of all, I do not like dark eyes who think themselves above their stations.
I have trouble feeling sympathy for you.
Roshan sneered. He looked down at his meal, as if it had lost any flavor.
Very well. Let us make an accommodation. I will take 9/10 of the spheres. You can have the rest.
Cal stood up indignantly.
My father will never—
Cal,
Liren cut in.
I can speak for myself. Surely you won't make a deal, though.
Liren didn't reply immediately. Finally, he said,
Go to the kitchens, Cal. Ask them if they have some food more to your tastes.
Father, no. Go, son.
Liren's voice was firm. Was it true? After all of this, would his father simply capitulate? Cal felt his face grow red and he fled the dining room. He knew the way to the kitchens. During his childhood, he'd often dined there with Laurel. He left, not because he was told to, but because he didn't want his father or Roshan to see his emotions. Chagrin at having stood to denounce Roshan when his father planned to make a deal. Humiliation that his father would consider a deal. Frustration at being banished. Cal was mortified to find himself crying. He passed a couple of Roshan's house soldiers standing at the doorway, lit only by a very low-trimmed oil lamp on the wall. Their rough features were highlighted in amber hues. Cal hastened past them, turning a corner before pausing beside a plant stand, struggling with his emotions. The stand displayed an indoor vine bud, one bred to remain open. A few cone-like flowers climbed up from its vestigial shell. The lamp on the wall above it burned with a tiny, strangled light. These were the back rooms of the mansion, near the servant quarters, and spheres were not used for light here. Cal leaned back, breathing in and out. He felt like one of the 10 fools, specifically Kabeen, who acted like a child, though he was adult. But what was he to think of Liren's actions? He wiped his eyes, then pushed his way through the swinging doors into the kitchens. Roshan still employed Wistio's chef. Barm was a tall, slender man with dark hair that he wore braided. He walked down the line of his kitchen counter, giving instructions to his various sub-chefs, as a couple of parshmen walked in and out through the mansion's back doors, carrying in crates of food. Barm carried a long metal spoon, which he banged on a pot or pan, hanging from the ceiling each time he gave an order. He barely spared Cal a brown-eyed glance, then told one of his servants to go fetch some flatbread and fruited talu rice. A child's meal. Cal felt even more embarrassed that Barm had known instantly why he had been sent to the kitchens. Cal walked to the dining nook to wait for the food. It was a whitewashed alcove with a slate-topped table. He sat down, elbows on the stone, head on his hands. Why did it make him so angry to think that his father might bargain away most of the spheres in exchange for safety? True, if that happened, there wouldn't be enough to send Cal to Carbranth. But he'd already decided to become a soldier, so it didn't matter. Did it? I am going to join the army, Cal thought. I'll run away. I'll— Suddenly, that dream, that plan, seemed incredibly childish. It belonged to a boy who ought to eat fruited meals and deserved to be sent away when the men talked of important topics. For the first time, the thought of not training with the surgeons filled him with regret. The door into the kitchens banged open. Roshan's son, Riller, sauntered in, chatting with the person behind him.
Don't know why Father insists on keeping everything so dreary around here all the time. Oil lamps in the hallways? Could he be any more provincial? It would do him some real good if I could get him out on a hunt or two. We might as well get some use out of being in this remote place.
Riller noticed Cal sitting there, but passed over him as one might register the presence of a stool or a shelf for wine, noting it, but otherwise ignoring it. Cal's own eyes were on the person who followed Riller. Laurel. Wistio's daughter. So much had changed. It had been so long, and seeing her brought up old emotions. Shame. Excitement. Did she know that his parents had been hoping to marry him to her? Merely seeing her again almost flustered him completely. But no. His father could look Roshon in the eyes. He could do the same with her. Cal stood up and nodded to her. She glanced at him and blushed faintly, walking in with an old nurse in tow, a chaperone. What had happened to the Laurel he'd known? The girl with the loose yellow and black hair who liked climbing on rocks and running through fields. Now she was wrapped up in sleek yellow silk, a stylish light-eyed woman's dress, her neatly coiffed hair dyed black to hide the blonde. Her left hand was hidden modestly in her sleeve. Laurel looked like a light eyes. Wistio's wealth, what was left of it, had gone to her. And when Roshon had been given authority over Hearthstone and granted the mansion and surrounding lands, High Prince Satius had given Laurel a dowry in compensation.
You,
Riller said, nodding to Cal and speaking in a smooth city accent.
Be a good lad and fetch us some supper. We'll take it here in the nook.
I'm not a kitchen servant.
So?
Cal flushed.
If you're expecting some kind of tip or reward for just fetching me a meal, I'm not... I mean...
Cal looked to Laurel.
Tell him, Laurel.
She looked away.
Well, go on, boy, she said. Do as you're told. We're hungry.
Cal gaped at her, then felt his face redden even more.
I'm not going to fetch you anything, he managed to say. I wouldn't do it no matter how many spears you offer me. I'm not an errand boy. I'm a surgeon.
Oh, you're that one's son.
I am,
Cal said, surprised at how proudly he felt those words.
I'm not going to be bullied by you, Rilla Roshon, just like my father isn't bullied by yours.
Except they're making a deal right now.
Father didn't mention how amusing you were, Riller said, leaning back against the wall.
He seemed a decade older than Cal, not a mere 2 years.
So you find it shameful to fetch a man his meal? Being a surgeon makes you that much better than the kitchen staff? Well, no. It's just not my calling. Then what is your calling?
Making sick people well.
And if I don't eat, won't I be sick? So couldn't you call it your duty to see me fed?
Cal frowned.
It's not the same thing at all.
I see it as being very similar.
Look, why don't you just go get yourself some food?
It's not my calling.
Then what is your calling?
Cal returned, throwing the man's own words back at him.
I'm city heir, Riller said. My duty is to lead, to see that jobs get done and that people are occupied in productive work. And as such, I give important tasks to idling dark eyes to make them useful.
Cal hesitated, growing angry.
You see how his little mind works, Riller said to Laurel. Like a dying fire, burning what little fuel it has, pumping out smoke. Ah, and look, his face grows red from the heat of it.
Riller, please,
Laurel said, laying her hand on his arm. Riller glanced at her, then rolled his eyes.
You're as provincial as my father sometimes, dear.
He stood up straight and, with a look of resignation, led her past the nook and into the kitchen proper. Cal sat back down hard, nearly bruising his legs on the bench with the force of it. A serving boy brought him his food and set it on the table, but that only reminded Cal of his childishness. So he didn't eat it, He just stared at it until eventually his father walked into the kitchen. Rilla and Laurel were gone by then. Liren walked to the alcove and surveyed Cal.
You didn't eat.
Cal shook his head.
You should have. It was free.
Come on. They walked in silence from the mansion into the dark night.
The carriage awaited them, and soon Cal again sat facing his father.
The driver climbed into place, making the vehicle quiver, and a snap of his whip set the horses in motion.
I want to be a surgeon, Cal said suddenly.
His father's face, hidden in shadow, was unreadable. But when he spoke, he sounded confused.
I know that, son.
No, I want to be a surgeon. I don't want to run away to join the war.
Silence in the darkness.
You were considering that?
Liren asked.
Yes, Cal admitted. It was childish, but I've decided for myself that I want to learn surgery instead.
Why? What made you change?
I need to know how they think,
Cal said, nodding back toward the mansion.
They're trained to speak their sentences in knots, and I have to be able to face them and talk back at them, not fold like...
He hesitated.
Like I did?
Liren asked with a sigh. Cal bit his lip, but had to ask.
How many spheres did you agree to give him? Will I still have enough to go to Carbranth?
I didn't give him a thing.
But
Roshon and I talked for a time, arguing over amounts. I pretended to grow hot-headed and left.
Pretended?
Cal asked, confused.
His father leaned forward, whispering to make certain the driver couldn't hear.
With the bouncing and the noise of the wheels on the stone, there was little danger of that.
He has to think that I'm willing to bend. Today's meeting was about giving the appearance of desperation. A strong front at first, followed by frustration. Letting him think that he'd gotten to me. Finally, a retreat. He'll invite me again in a few months, after letting me sweat.
But you won't bend then, either?
Cal whispered.
No. Giving him any of the spheres would make him greedy for the rest. These lands don't produce as they used to, and Roshon is nearly broke from losing political battles. I still don't know which High Lord was behind sending him here to torment us, though I wish I had him for a few moments in a dark room.
The ferocity with which Liren said that shocked Cal. It was the closest he'd ever heard his father come to threatening real violence.
But why go through this in the first place?
Cal whispered.
You said that we can keep resisting him. Mother thinks so, too. We won't eat well, but we won't starve.
His father didn't reply, though he looked troubled.
You need to make him think that we're capitulating, Cal said, or that we're close to doing so, so that he'll stop looking for ways to undermine us, so that he'll focus his attention on making a deal and not...
Cal froze. He saw something unfamiliar in his father's eyes. Something like guilt. Suddenly it made sense. Cold, terrible sense.
Stormfather, Cal whispered. You did steal the spheres, didn't you?
His father remained silent, riding in the old carriage, shadowed in black.
That's why you've been so tense since Wistio died, Cal whispered. The drinking, the worrying. You're a thief. We're a family of thieves.
The carriage turned, and the violet light of Salis illuminated Liren's face. He didn't look half so ominous from that angle. In fact, he looked fragile. He clasped his hands before him, eyes reflecting moonlight.
Wistio was not lucid during the final days, Cal,
he whispered.
I knew that, with his death, we would lose the promise of a union. Laurel had not reached her day of majority, and the new city lord wouldn't let a Dark Eyes take her inheritance through marriage.
So you robbed him?
Cal felt himself shrinking.
I made certain that promises were kept. I had to do something. I couldn't trust the generosity of the new city lord,
wisely, as you can see.
All of this time, Cal had assumed that Rishon was persecuting them out of malice and spite, but it turned out he was justified.
I can't believe it.
Does it change so much?
Liren whispered. His face looked haunted in the dim light.
What is different now?
Everything.
And yet nothing.
Rishon still wants those spheres, and we still deserve them. Wistio, if he'd been fully lucid, would have given us those spheres, I'm certain.
But he didn't.
No.
Things were the same, yet different. One step and the world flipped upside down. The villain became the hero the villain. Cal said.
I can't decide if what you did was incredibly brave or incredibly wrong.
Liren sighed.
I know how you feel.
He sat back.
Please don't tell Tien what we've done.
What we've done. Asena had helped him.
When you are older, you'll understand.
Maybe,
Cal said, shaking his head.
But one thing hasn't changed. I want to go to Carbranth.
Even on stolen spheres?
I'll find a way to pay them back. Not to Rishon, to Laurel.
She'll be a Rishon before too long, Liren said. We should expect an engagement between her and Rilla before the year is out. Rishon will not let her slip away, not now that he's lost political favor in Kolinar. She represents one of the few chances his son has for an alliance with a good house.
Cal felt his stomach turn at the mention of Laurel.
I have to learn. Perhaps I can...
Can what, he thought. Come back and convince her to leave Rilla for me? Ridiculous. He looked up suddenly at his father, who had bowed his head, looking sorrowful. He was a hero. A villain, too. But a hero to his family.
I won't tell Tien, Cal whispered. And I'm going to use the spheres to travel to Kolinar and study.
His father looked up.
I want to learn to face light eyes like you do, Cal said. Any of them can make a fool of me. I want to learn to talk like them, think like them.
I want you to learn so that you can help people, son. Not so you can get back at the light eyes.
I think I can do both. If I can learn to be clever enough.
Liren snorted.
You're plenty clever, son. You've got enough of your mother and you to talk circles around a light eyes. The university will show you how, Cal.
I want to start going by my full name, he replied, surprising himself. Kaladin.
It was a man's name. He'd always disliked how it sounded like the name of a light eyes. Now it seemed to fit. He wasn't a dark-eyed farmer, but he wasn't a light-eyed lord either. Something in between. Cal had been a child who wanted to join the army because it was what other boys dreamed of. Kaladin would be a man who learned surgery and all the ways of the Light Eyes. And someday he would return to this town and prove to Rishon, Rilla, and Laurel herself that they had been wrong to dismiss him.
Very well, Liren said. Kaladin.
Thirty-eight. Envisager. Born from the darkness, they bear its taint still, marked upon their bodies much as the fire marks their souls. I consider Geshash son Navamis a trustworthy source, though I'm not certain about this translation. Find the original quote in the 14th book of Seld and retranslate it myself, perhaps? Kaladin floated. Persistent fever, accompanied by cold sweats and hallucinations, likely causes infected wounds. Clean with antiseptic to ward away rot spren. Keep the subject hydrated. He was back in Hearthstone with his family, only he was a grown man, the soldier he had become. And he didn't fit with them anymore. His father kept asking, how did this happen?
You said you wanted to become a surgeon.
A surgeon.
Broken ribs, caused by trauma to the side, inflicted by a beating. Wrap the chest and prevent the subject from taking part in strenuous activity. Occasionally, he'd open his eyes and see a dark room. It was cold, the walls made of stone, with a high roof. Other people lay in lines, covered in blankets. Corpses. They were corpses. This was a warehouse where they were lined up for sale. Who bought corpses? High Prince Satius. He bought corpses. They still walked after he bought them, but they were corpses. The stupid ones refused to accept it, pretending they were alive. Lacerations on face, arms, and chest. Outer layer of skin stripped away in several patches, caused by prolonged exposure to high storm winds. Bandage wounded areas, apply a Denacax salve to encourage new skin growth. Time was passing. A lot of it. He should be dead. Why wasn't he dead? He wanted to lie back and let it happen. But no. No. He had failed Tien. He had failed Goshal. He had failed his parents. He had failed Dalet. Dear Dalet. He would not fail Bridge 4. He would not. Hypothermia caused by extreme cold. Warm subject and force him to remain seated. Do not let him sleep. If he survives a few hours, there will likely be no lasting after effects. If he survives a few hours? Bridgemen weren't supposed to survive. Why would Lamoral say that? What army would employ men who were supposed to die? His perspective had been too narrow, too short-sighted. He needed to understand the army's objectives. He watched the battle's progress, horrified. What had he done? He needed to go back and change it. But no. He was wounded, wasn't he? He was bleeding on the ground. He was one of the fallen spearmen. He was a bridgeman from Bridge 2, betrayed by those fools in Bridge 4 who diverted all of the archers. How dare they? How dare they? How dare they survive by killing me? Strained tendons, ripped muscles, bruised and cracked bones, and pervasive soreness caused by extreme conditions. Enforce bed rest by any means necessary. Check for large and persistent bruises or pallor caused by internal hemorrhaging. That can be life-threatening. Be prepared for surgery. He saw the death spren. They were fist size and black, with many legs and deep red eyes that glowed, leaving trails of burning light. They clustered around him, skittering this way and that. Their voices were whispers, scratchy sounds like paper being torn. They terrified him, but he couldn't escape them. He could barely move. Only the dying could see death spren. You saw them, then died. Only the very, very lucky few survived after that. Death spren knew when the end was close. Blistered fingers and toes caused by frost nip. Make sure to apply antiseptic to any blisters that break. Encourage the body's natural healing. Permanent damage is unlikely. Standing before the death spren was a tiny figure of light. Not translucent, as she had always appeared before, but of pure white light. That soft, feminine face had a nobler, more angular cast to it now, like a warrior from a forgotten time. Not childlike at all. She stood guard on his chest, holding a sword made of light. That glow was so pure, so sweet. It seemed to be the glow of life itself. Whenever one of the death spren got too close, she would charge at it, wielding her radiant blade. The light warded them off. But there were a lot of death spren. More and more each time he was lucid enough to look. Severe delusions caused by trauma to the head. Maintain observation of subject. Do not allow alcohol intake. Enforce rest. Administer fathom bark to reduce cranial swelling. Fire moss can be used in extreme cases, but beware letting the subject form an addiction. If medication fails,
trepanning the skull may be needed to relieve pressure. Usually fatal. Teft entered the barrack at midday. Ducking into the shadowy interior was like entering a cave. He glanced to the left, where the other wounded usually slept. They were all outside at the moment, getting some sun. All five were doing well, even Leighton. Teft passed the lines of rolled-up blankets at the sides of the room, walking to the back of the chamber where Kaladin lay. Poor man, Teft thought. What's worse, being sick near to death, or having to stay all the way back here, away from the light? It was necessary. Bridge 4 walked a precarious line. They had been allowed to cut Kaladin down, and so far nobody had tried to stop them from caring for him. Practically the entire army had heard Sadeus give Kaladin to the Stormfather for judgment. Gaz had come to see Kaladin, then had snorted to himself in amusement. He'd likely told his superiors that Kaladin would die. Men didn't live long with wounds like those. Yet Kaladin hung on. Soldiers were going out of their way to try to get a peek at him. His survival was incredible. People were talking in camp. Given to the Stormfather for judgment, then spared. A miracle. Sadeus wouldn't like that. How long would it be before one of the Light Eyes decided to relieve their Bright Lord of the problem? Sadeus couldn't take any overt action, not without losing a great deal of credibility, but a quiet poisoning or suffocation would abbreviate the embarrassment. So Bridge 4 kept Kaladin as far from outside eyes as possible, and they always left someone with him. Always. Storming man, Teft thought, kneeling beside the feverish patient in his tousled blankets, eyes closed, face sweaty, body bound with a frightful number of bandages. Most were stained red. They didn't have the money to change them often. Scar kept watch currently. The short, strong-faced man sat at Kaladin's feet.
How is he? Teft asked.
Scar spoke softly.
He seems to be getting worse, Teft. I heard him mumble about dark shapes, thrashing and telling them to keep back. He opened his eyes. He didn't seem to see me, but he saw something. I swear it.
Death Spren, Teft thought, feeling a chill.
Collect preservers. I'll take a turn, Teft said, sitting. You go get something to eat.
Scar stood, looking pale. It would crush the other's spirit for Kaladin to survive the high storm, then die of his wounds. Scar shuffled from the room, shoulders slumped. Teft watched Kaladin for a long while, trying to gather his thoughts, his emotions.
Why now? He whispered. Why here? After so many have watched and waited, you come here?
But of course Teft was getting ahead of himself. He didn't know for certain. He only had assumptions and hopes. No, not hopes. Fears. He had rejected the envisagers, and yet here he was. He fished in his pocket and pulled out three small diamond spheres. It had been a long, long while since he'd saved anything of his wages, but he'd held on to these, thinking, worrying. They glowed with stormlight in his hand. Did he really want to know? Gritting his teeth, Teft moved closer to Kaladin's side, looking down at the unconscious man's face.
You bastard, he whispered. You storming bastard. You took a bunch of hanged men and lifted them up just enough to breathe. Now you're going to leave them? I won't have it, you hear? I won't.
He pressed the spheres into Kaladin's hand, wrapping the limp fingers around them, then laying the hand on Kaladin's abdomen. Then Teft sat back on his heels. What would happen? All the envisagers had were stories and legends. Fool's tales, Teft had called them. Idle dreams. He waited. Of course nothing happened.
You're as big a fool as any, Teft, he told himself.
He reached for Kaladin's hand. Those spheres would buy a few drinks. Kaladin gasped suddenly, drawing in a short, quick, powerful breath. The glow in his hand faded. Teft froze, eyes widening. Wisps of light began to rise from Kaladin's body. It was faint, but there was no mistaking that glowing white stormlight streaming off his frame. It was as if Kaladin had been bathed in sudden heat, and his very skin steamed. Kaladin's eyes snapped open, and they leaked light too, faintly colored amber. He gasped again loudly, and the trailing wisps of light began to twist around the exposed cuts on his chest. A few of them pulled together and knit themselves up. Then it was gone. The light of those tiny chips expended. Kaladin's eyes closed, and he relaxed. His wounds were still bad, his fever still raging, but some color had returned to his skin. The puffy redness around several cuts had diminished.
"My God," Teft said, realizing he was trembling. "Almighty cast from heaven to dwell in our hearts. It is true."
He bowed his head to the rock floor, squeezing his eyes shut, tears leaking from their corners.
"Why now?" he thought again. "Why here? And in the name of all heaven, why me?"
He knelt for 100 heartbeats, counting, thinking, worrying. Eventually he pulled himself to his feet and retrieved the spheres, now done, from Kaladin's hand. He'd need to trade them for spheres with light in them. Then he could return and let Kaladin drain those as well. He'd have to be careful. A few spheres each day, but not too many. If the boy healed too quickly, it would draw too much attention.
"And I need to tell the Envisagers," he thought. "I need to..."
The Envisagers were gone. Dead, because of what he had done. If there were others, he had no idea how to locate them.
Who would he tell? Who would believe him?
Kaladin himself probably didn't understand what he was doing. Best to keep it quiet, at least until he could figure out what to do about it.
Thirty-nine. Burned into her. Within a heartbeat, Alizarv was there, crossing a distance that would have taken more than 4 months to travel by foot. Another folktale, this one recorded in Among the Dark-Eyed, by Callanum, page 102. Stories of instantaneous travel and the Oath Gates pervade these tales. Shallan's hand flew across the drawing board, moving as if of its own accord, charcoal scratching, sketching, smudging. Thick lines first, like trails of blood left by a thumb drawn across rough granite. Tiny lines like scratches made by a pin. She sat in her closet-like stone chamber in the conclave. No windows, no ornamentation on the granite walls, just the bed, her trunk, the nightstand, and the small desk that doubled as a drawing table. A single ruby brome cast a bloody light on her sketch. Usually, to produce a vibrant drawing, she had to consciously memorize a scene, a blink, freezing the world, imprinting it into her mind. She hadn't done that during Yasna's annihilation of the thieves. She'd been too frozen by horror or morbid fascination. Despite that, she could see each of those scenes in her mind just as vividly as if she'd deliberately memorized them, and these memories didn't vanish when she drew them. She couldn't rid her mind of them. Those deaths were burned into her. She sat back from her drawing board, hand shaking. The picture before her, an exact charcoal representation of the suffocating nightscape, squeezed between alley walls, a tortured figure of flame rising toward the sky. At that moment, its face still held its shape, shadow eyes wide and burning lips agape. Yasna's hand was toward the figure, as if warding or worshipping. Shallan drew her charcoal-stained fingers to her chest, staring at her creation.
It was one of dozens of drawings she'd done during the last few days. The man turned into fire, the other frozen into crystal, the two transmuted to smoke. She could only draw one of those two fully. She'd been facing down the alleyway to the east. Her drawings of the fourth man's death were of smoke rising, clothing already on the ground. She felt guilty for being unable to record his death, and she felt stupid for that guilt. Logic did not condemn Jasnah. Yes, the princess had gone willingly into danger, but that didn't remove responsibility from those who had chosen to hurt her. The men's actions were reprehensible. Shallan had spent the days poring through books on philosophy, and most ethical frameworks exonerated the princess. But Shallan had been there. She'd watched those men die. She'd seen the terror in their eyes, and she felt terrible. Hadn't there been another way? Kill or be killed. That was the philosophy of starkness. It exonerated Jasnah. Actions are not evil. Intent is evil, and Jasnah's intent had been to stop men from harming others. That was the philosophy of purpose. It lauded Jasnah. Morality is separate from the ideals of men. It exists whole somewhere to be approached but never truly understood by the mortal. The philosophy of ideals. It claimed that removing evil was ultimately moral, and so in destroying evil men, Jasnah was justified. Objective must be weighed against methods. If the goal is worthy, then the steps taken are worthwhile, even if some of them, on their own, are reprehensible. The philosophy of aspiration. It, more than any, called Jasnah's actions ethical. Shallan pulled the sheet from her drawing board and tossed it down beside the others scattered across her bed. Her fingers moved again, clutching the charcoal pencil, beginning a new picture on the blank sheet strapped in place on the table, unable to escape. Her theft nagged at her as much as the killings did. Ironically, Jasnah's demand that Shallan study moralistic philosophy forced her to contemplate her own terrible actions. She'd come to Carbranth to steal the Fabriel, then use it to save her brothers and their house from massive debt and destruction. Yet in the end, this wasn't why Shallan had stolen the soul caster. She'd taken it because she was angry with Jasnah. If the intentions were more important than the action, then she had to condemn herself. Perhaps the philosophy of aspiration, which stated that objectives were more important than the steps taken to achieve them, would agree with what she'd done. But that was the philosophy she found most reprehensible. Shallan sat here sketching, condemning Jasnah. But Shallan was the one who had betrayed a woman who had trusted her and taken her in. Now she was planning to commit heresy with the soulcaster by using it, although she was not an ardent. The soulcaster itself lay in the hidden part of Shallan's trunk. 3 days, and Jasnah had said nothing about the disappearance. She wore the fake each day. She said nothing, acted no differently. Maybe she hadn't tried soulcasting. Almighty send that she didn't go out and put herself into danger again, expecting to be able to use the Fabriel to kill men who attacked her. Of course, there was one other aspect of that night that Shallan had to think of. She carried a concealed weapon that she hadn't used. She felt foolish for not even thinking of getting it out that night. But she wasn't accustomed to... Shallan froze, realizing for the first time what she'd been drawing. Not another scene from the alleyway, but a lavish room with a thick ornamented rug and swords on the walls. A long dining table set with a half-eaten meal. And a dead man in fine clothing, lying face first on the floor, blood pooling around him. She jumped back, tossing aside the charcoal, then crumpled up the paper. Shaking, she moved over and sat down on the bed among the pictures. Dropping the crumpled drawing, she raised her fingers to her forehead, feeling the cold sweat there. Something was wrong with her. With her drawings. She had to get out. Escape the death, the philosophy, and the questions.
She stood and hurriedly strode into the main room of Jasnah's quarters. The princess herself was away researching, as always. She hadn't demanded that Shallan come to the Vale today. Was that because she realized that her ward needed time to think alone? Or was it because she suspected Shallan of stealing the Soulcaster and no longer trusted her? Shallan hurried through the room. It was furnished only with the basics provided by King Taravangian. Shallan pulled open the door to the hallway and nearly ran into a master servant who had been reaching up to knock. The woman started, and Shallan let out a yelp. "Brightness," the woman said, bowing immediately. "Apologies, but one of your span reeds is flashing." The woman held up the reed, affixed on the side with a small blinking ruby. Shallan breathed in and out, stilling her heart. "Thank you," she said. She, like Jasnah, left her span reeds in the care of servants because she was often away from her rooms and was likely to miss any attempt to contact her. Still flustered, she was tempted to leave the thing and continue on her way. However, she did need to speak with her brothers, Nan-Balat particularly, and he'd been away the last few times she'd contacted home. She took the span reed and closed the door. She didn't dare return to her rooms, with all of those sketches accusing her, but there was a desk and a span reed board in the main room. She sat there, then twisted the ruby. "Shallan," the reed wrote, "are you comfortable?" It was a code phrase, meant to indicate to her that it was indeed Nan-Balat, or at least his betrothed, on the other side. "My back hurts and my wrist itches," she wrote back, giving the other half of the code phrase. "I'm sorry I missed your other communications," Nan-Balat sent. "I had to attend a feast in Father's name. It was with Sur Kamar, so it wasn't really something I could miss, despite the day of traveling each way." "It's all right," Shallan wrote. She took a deep breath. "I have the item." She turned the gem. The reed was still for a long moment. Finally, a hurried hand wrote, "Praise the heralds. Oh, Shallan, you've done it. You are on your way back to us, then? How can you use the span reed on the ocean? Are you in port?" "I haven't left," Shallan wrote. "What? Why?" "Because it would be too suspicious," she wrote. "Think about it, Nan-Balat. If Jasnah tries the item and finds it broken, she might not immediately decide that she's been had. That changes if I've suddenly and suspiciously left for home. I have to wait until she's made the discovery, then see what she does next. If she realizes that her Fabriel was replaced with a fake, then I can deflect her toward other culprits. She's already suspicious of the Ardentia. If, on the other hand, she assumes that her Fabriel has broken somehow, I'll know we're free." She twisted the gem, setting the span reed in place. The question she'd been expecting came next. "And if she immediately assumes that you did it?" "Shallan, what if you can't deflect her suspicion? What if she orders a search of your chambers and they find the hidden compartment?" She picked up the pen. "Then it is still better for me to be here," she wrote. "Balat, I have learned much about Jasnah Kolin. She is incredibly focused and determined. She will not let me escape if she thinks I have robbed her. She will hunt me down and will use all of her resources to exact retribution. We'd have our own king and high princes on our property in days, demanding that we turn over the Fabriel. Stormfather, I'll bet Jasnah has contacts in Yakaved that she could reach before I got back. I'd find myself in custody the moment I landed. Our only hope is to deflect her. If that doesn't work, better for me to be here and suffer her wrath quickly. Likely she would take the Soulcaster and banish me from her sight. If we make her work and chase after me, though, she can be very ruthless, Balat. It would not go well for us." The response was long in coming. "When did you get so good at logic, small one?" he finally sent. "I see that you've thought this through. Better than I have, at least. But Shallan, our time is running out." "I know," she wrote.
You said you could hold things together for a few more months. I ask you to do that. Give me 2 or 3 weeks at least to see what Jasnah does. Besides, while I am here, I can look into how the thing works. I haven't found any books that give hints, but there are so many here, maybe I just haven't found the right one yet. Very well, he wrote. A few weeks. Be careful, small one. The men who gave Father his Fabriel visited again. They asked after you. I'm worried about them. Even more than I worry about our finances. They disturb me in a profound way. Farewell. Farewell, she wrote back. So far there had been no hint of reaction from the princess. She hadn't even mentioned the soulcaster. That made Shallan nervous. She wished that Jasnah would just say something. The waiting was excruciating. Each day while she sat with Jasnah, Shallan's stomach churned with anxiety until she was nauseated. At least, considering the killings a few days ago, Shallan had a very good excuse for looking disturbed. Cold, calm logic. Jasnah herself would be proud. A knock came at the door, and Shallan quickly gathered up the conversation she'd had with Nan Balat and burned it in the hearth. A palace maid entered a moment later, carrying a basket in the crook of her arm. She smiled at Shallan. It was time for the daily cleaning. Shallan had a strange moment of panic at seeing the woman. She wasn't one of the maids Shallan recognized. What if Jasnah had sent her or someone else to search Shallan's room? Had she done so already? Shallan nodded to the woman, and then, to assuage her worries, she walked to her room and closed the door. She rushed to the chest and checked the hidden compartment. The Fabriel was there. She lifted it out, inspecting it. Would she know if Jasnah somehow reversed the exchange? You're being foolish, she told herself. Jasnah's subtle, but she's not that subtle. Still, Shallan stuffed the soulcaster in her safe pouch. It just barely fit inside the envelope-like cloth container. She'd feel safer knowing she had it on her while the maid cleaned her room. Besides, the safe pouch might be a better hiding place for it than her trunk.